Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to Teleclass Education. My name is Paul Weber, and I'm one of the co-founders of this lecture series, along with Professor Syed Sattar. Today, we are pleased to bring you Infection Prevention and Social Change. Now, this is the 11th time that I've had the privilege of introducing today's presenter. Dr. Elaine Larson has been a good friend of Teleclass Education since 2003. Now, I won't go through her entire CV because it would simply take too long. But in brief, she is the Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Pharmaceutical and Therapeutic Research at the Columbia University School of Nursing. She has been President of the Certification Board for Infection Control, a director and trustee for the APIC Research Foundation. She has served on or led more committees, working groups, and boards than I can probably mention. She has been the editor of the American Journal of Infection Control for almost 20 years and has, in that time, somehow managed to produce some 200 journal articles, 4 books, and a whole bunch of book chapters on infection prevention and control and epidemiology topics. She has traveled the world as a conference speaker and consultant and is perhaps one of the, if not the, most recognized names in infection prevention and control. So it is my pleasure to introduce for the 11th time Dr. Elaine Larson to present her teleclass, Infection Prevention and Social Change. Elaine.
Thank you, Paul. And first, let me start with a caveat to say that I know that this is a little bit U.S.-centric, and I do apologize for that because some of the social changes that I'm going to talk about are sort of specific to the U.S., but I hope that the rest of you will find some things that are relevant, and I think you probably will. So let's start right out. I have some declarations here of research funding and so forth. And then on the next slide, I'm just going to tell you that we're going to talk about some social changes relevant to infection control, focusing on 3 changes. One is reimbursement strategies from the government for payment for health care. The second is mandatory reporting and increasing transparency and consumer involvement in healthcare-associated infections. The third is increasing regulation of research. And then I'm going to end by talking about the role of leadership in prevention behaviors and what we can do in response to this changing social landscape. So let's start on the next slide with these 3 social changes. And on the next slide, we're going to talk about reimbursement strategies. Next slide, you are familiar, if you're in the U.S. at least, in the Deficit Reduction Act, which was generated by the Secretary of Health and Human Services to identify high-cost, high-volume preventable conditions that result in higher payments. So as of October 1st of 2008, our Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, which reimburses a large proportion of health care costs in this country, denied payment for 10 hospital-acquired conditions that were thought to be preventable. 3 of these conditions are health care-associated infections. Those are selected surgical site infections, vascular catheter-associated infections, and catheter-associated urinary tract infections. It used to be that one was reimbursed for any amount as long as the person was in the hospital, if they got an infection, the hospital actually received more payment because the patient's costs were higher. And this was an effort and is an effort to try to change the incentive to actually prevent infections and move patients out of the hospital more quickly. The next page is a title of a paper that Dr. Pat Stone took the lead on. I'm a collaborator with her on a number of the studies that we're going to talk about. And this was a paper published in Medical Care a couple of years ago called Center for Medicare and Medicaid services, changes in reimbursement for HIIs, setting a research agenda. What we decided to do was because every time the reimbursement strategies change, there are the effort is to try to improve care at more efficient cost and reduce cost, but there are always some unexpected, untoward events. So we got a grant from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality to hold a workshop in 2009 with a bunch of experts, and on the next page or two are a couple of pictures of some of the people. We invited 41 experts from across the nation who were either experts in infection control and infectious diseases, or they were policymakers nationally known, to help us come up, brainstorm and come up with a research agenda to find out, to try to evaluate the impact of these reimbursement changes on patient care and practices. So the next couple of pages, you see the morning presentations. You see Teresa Horan there. And then on the next slide, the afternoon presentations, we heard about creating an environment, a learning environment, and other payer and provider responses to healthcare-associated infections. Sherry Gleed is pictured there. She was until last month the assistant secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services for planning and evaluation. She now works back with me here at Columbia. So the results of this workshop were that the consensus was that we did need research. It needed to be theory-driven. In other words, we can't just say, all right, CMS has changed the reimbursement, so that's it. We have to have some rationale for why we think it's going to help. And the clinician's response to this change in reimbursement can certainly be predicted using behavioral theory. The idea that the CMS changes in reimbursement could serve as an incentive or a stimulus to change their behavior, and environmental, organizational, provider, and patient characteristics are certainly mediating variables that impact the outcomes. And then there was consensus that organizational theory and management research can help to understand the relationship between organizational culture and staff behavior. So on the next slide, based on this workshop, Dr. Stone and we developed a model. And on the left-hand side, you see that we were postulating that the change in reimbursement would have an impact on environmental factors for sure, payment and market factors, and hopefully have an impact on organizational factors, particularly leadership behavior, staff behavior, and then ultimately the idea is to improve patient outcomes, reduce infections, and reduce costs. So the next, and that's still in process, actually. There are several studies now that have been funded to look at the impact, the longer-term impact of these changes in reimbursement strategies. And we don't, you know, the jury is still out on that. We don't really know. But the last major changes in the 1980s in reimbursement did not result in reduced costs or improved outcomes. So let's hope it does this time. So the next slide, the second social change I wanted to just touch on, is the fact that now many of our states require public reporting of healthcare-associated infections, and there's a lot more attention in the lay press among patients and consumers about infections. So there's much more urgency and pressure for transparency. We don't want hospitals to be hiding their infection rates and so forth. Next slide. This just shows you in 2003, these are slides from the APIC website, that in 2003, there were two states that had mandatory reporting of infection rates. Next, you see in 2006 that it's grown considerably. And then in 2011, you see that a large portion of the country is now mandating some form of public reporting for infection. The next slide shows that all of the states do require hospital inpatient quality reporting programs if they are going to be getting reimbursement from the government for health care. So these are major changes in mandatory reporting. On the next slide, you see that even for long-term care, HAI reporting is mandated in a few states, not as many as for hospital reporting, but it's likely to continue to increase. And then next, you see, again, for ambulatory surgical centers, that we have mandatory HAI reporting in a number of states as well. So next, this is a Senate bill from California that was passed in January of 2009. And California has some of the most prescriptive rules and regulations about reporting. They require now quarterly reporting on all healthcare-associated MRSA bloodstream infections, C. difficile infections, VRE bloodstream infections, and the number of inpatient days. For in terms of surgical site infections, California also requires reporting of deep organ space sites, orthopedics, cardiac, and GI sites. And they require monthly reporting through the CDC's National Health Safety Network. And as you probably know, a few years ago, there were the National Health Safety Network, NHSN, was voluntary, and there were just a couple of hundred hospitals that were reporting. And now there are many hundreds, and in California, it's mandatory to report through the NHSN. They require hospital-wide reporting of central line-associated bloodstream infections and central line days. The next slide talks about some of the problems with these state mandatory reporting laws, and that is that they vary tremendously across states. The dilemma is that it's impossible to compare rates because each state has different types of infections, different numbers of HAIs that are required to report. They require different process measures. For example, some ask about infection prevention staffing, and some of them are still voluntary versus mandatory. And some of them require actually having a website or some kind of open public reporting, whereas others just require reporting to the health department. So Pat Stone and her group are now doing an analysis of these state laws to look at the variations across the state laws, because right now we really can't do much in the way of comparison and evaluating the impact of these laws. The next slide talks about her one of our recent studies, the California Infection Prevention and Control Department's Resources and Effectiveness Study. You have the reference there if you'd like to look it up. And the next slide is just a picture of the study that the timeline of the study. The idea was to survey as many hospitals in California as were willing to look at the impact of the California Healthcare Associated Infection Prevention Initiatives, and also to look at the impact of the CMS regulations and state mandatory reporting. So you see, what we did was we had one survey in 2008, just about at the same time as the CMS regulations changed, but right before state mandatory reporting. And then in 2009, we actually made site visits to a few hospitals and did interviews with some of the staff to get a better qualitative sense of the impact of these various initiatives on their practice and work. And then we did a third survey in 2010 to look at how things had changed over time. So in the next slide, it shows you that in Survey 1, which was 2008, we had 207 hospitals that participated. That was a 69% recruitment rate across the entire state. In Survey 2, we had a 71% recruitment rate, And there were no significant differences in hospital demographics between the two surveys. Next slide, we start to see some of the results of the impact on processes, infection prevention processes. So what you see is that between 2008 and 2010, infection preventionists reported that they spent significantly more time on surveillance, about more than a third of their time was on surveillance. They spent significantly less time on education of staff comparing 2010 to 2008, and they also spent significantly more time in the office. These, as you can see, are not necessarily desirable changes in the processes and practices. And the next slide, what you see is whether or not between 2008, which is Survey 1, and 2010, which is Survey 2, the percentages that are highlighted in red were significantly better in 2010. So what this shows is that for many policies related to CLABSIs, ventilator-associated pneumonia, catheter-associated UTIs, and surgical site infections, the various institutions were significantly more likely, frequently, to have those policies in place. So even though the infection preventionist time may not have changed completely in the desirable ways, there certainly were present more policies related to guidelines for these various infections. In addition, the actual HAI rates decreased in the medical surgical ICUs during this time period for catheter-associated bloodstream infections. In 2008, the rate was 2.3 per 1,000 Lyme days, and at time 2, it had halved to 1.1. The same with ventilator-associated pneumonia rates. At time 1, 2.6 per 1,000 ventilator days, and then at time 2, 1.3 per 1,000 ventilator days. The numbers in parentheses are the numbers of ICUs that reported these rates. The next slide, you see the title and the citation for the qualitative portion of this study that we did. And the first author is one of our doctoral students. And the next slide, in terms of our methods, this was a purposive sample of 6 hospitals, all of which were in California, participating in the consortium for healthcare-associated infection prevention initiative, or the California healthcare-associated infection prevention initiative. And we picked those places to be representative from various places across the state. The red dots in the map of California show you where those sites were. We used open-ended questions and that were structured around Donna Beedian's framework, which is looking at processes, outcomes, structure, processes, and outcomes. We interviewed 25 hospital staff during the summer of 2009. Each interview took about an hour. The next slide just summarizes how we analyzed the data. We used qualitative software. We had biweekly meetings with an expert qualitative researcher who did not know much about infection prevention, but her expertise was in qualitative design. The responses were coded independently by 2 different coders, and then 30% of the transcripts were double-coded, and the inter-rater agreement was more than 90% in terms of the categorizing of the responses. On the next slide, it just shows a picture of how the codes are clustered in this software, which is called NVivo software. You don't need to really look at it. I just wanted to show you sort of how the clustering was done by the software. And then the next slide summarizes the 4 major themes and sub-themes from the content analysis. What you see is that the 4 issues that the staff were most concerned about in terms of the impact on their practice were mandatory reporting electronic surveillance systems, role expansion, and organizational climate. So in terms of electronic reporting, there were some bad things and some good things from their perspective. They felt that there was heightened awareness of infection control, and yet they were frustrated because they felt that some of the comparisons in reporting were not really well controlled for or fair. And they were also frustrated with the increased workload that was resulting from the mandatory reporting. One of the major concerns is that the law determines what you do your monitoring for, when in fact in a certain hospital, let's say, for example, MRSA may not be a problem, but they still had to report that because that was the law. And they felt that that was too bad that they had fewer choices in what they actually focused on. Electronic surveillance systems, they felt helped their task efficiency, but they also found that getting a system up and running was frustrating. It took a lot of time, and as we showed you before, the amount of time that they spent in the office and they spent on surveillance actually over this period of time increased, when in fact the whole point of electronic surveillance is to save time and reduce the time needed in the office. So it'll be interesting to see after a few more years whether this electronic surveillance systems are going to be helpful in the long run. Certainly one would hope so. The third theme of those interviewed was role expansion. The infection preventionist felt that they were much more visible, that they were seen as experts and educators, but they were also seen sometimes as police, and they did not want to do that. They wanted to be more of a consultant and an educator. And they were expressed concerns about increasing time burden as they take on new responsibilities for outpatient clinics and for more reporting. And then interestingly, all of them commented on the importance of organizational values and communication and the organizational environment. And here were many, many comments about the importance of shared accountability, interdisciplinary collaboration, making sure that there was a good organizational climate in which people work. And they did comment on cost constraints and a focus among administration on cost savings. On the next slide, I just wanted to point out that sometimes the outcomes are not always clear-cut. For example, there are a couple of studies published this last year in the Medical Journal of Australia. And maybe some of you are listening from Australia and know Lindsay Grayson, but Staph aureus BSI and hand hygiene rates have been subject to public reporting in Australia for some time, and a national hand hygiene campaign was associated with widespread sustained improvements in hand hygiene compliance among healthcare workers. On the next slide, however, it shows another paper that was published just after that to show that there was an inverse relationship between hand hygiene compliance that was reported and Staph aureus BSI rates for 21 Australian hospitals. Now, this sort of goes against our intuitive grain and the grain of other evidence, but the point is that we can't always predict that certain processes will result with certain outcomes. So the next slide, sort of ask ourselves, why would that be? Why would it be that a successful hand hygiene campaign was not associated with a concomitant reduction in infection rates? Well, here are just some reasons, and I'm sure you can think of some others. One is that better hand washers may also be better reporters, and they may do better surveillance, and so they may find more infections. Another reason could be that the causes of bloodstream infection, of course, are multiple, and hand hygiene may have an impact, but not the only impact, and there may be other things that were going on. The third thing is that there might be no causal relationship between hand hygiene and bloodstream infection. That's probably not the case, but it's something that one always has to ask. And then, lastly, even if there were a causal relationship, sophisticated analyses are essential to tease out confounders and effect modifiers which may not have been controlled for in this analysis. That's just sort of a little side thing. So the conclusions on this part, talking about mandatory reporting, is that while there is some evidence that state and federal policies may be working, because there are many more of the appropriate guideline policies in place, there's likely to be both unintended and intended consequences related to the changes. Hence, we really need to evaluate these policies to inform decision makers, because we need evidence-based policy making as well as evidence-based clinical processes. And many times, unfortunately, policymakers don't have a lot of evidence or don't think about evaluating the changes in policies as they are being made. They still have to make decisions, but we need to evaluate them. The next slide is just another aside, which I think is ironic, and that is that the United States is way behind the European Union in controlling antibiotic use in animals. So although fluoroquinolones were banned from the U.S. poultry production in 2005, still in 2010, 70% of antibiotic use in animals were in healthy animals who were vulnerable to diseases because of crowded, unsanitary conditions. So this is just not appropriate to use antibiotics in lieu of creating more sanitary conditions. All right, so the third social change I wanted to talk about is the increasing regulation of research. And this is something of great interest to me because I am the chair of two institutional review boards, which are the ethics boards that review research, and I can tell you that there have been major changes over the past decade. So the next slide shows you the central line insertion checklist that was part of Peter Pronovost and his colleagues' original project at Johns Hopkins University that you may recall, the checklist project, in which they just, none of this was experimental. They just summarized the various evidence-based guidelines for what it takes to do a good central line insertion, hand hygiene, cleansing the site, disinfecting the site, various precautions. And then they empowered the nurses and others, people, staff in the unit, to stop a procedure if there were any breaks in aseptic technique. So on the next slide, you see this is the study design. It was a prospective study in a surgical ICU. The intervention was not just the checklist. It was also a cart and daily reminders, et cetera. And they looked at the impact on catheter-associated bloodstream infections, and they found that they were able to reduce the bloodstream infection rate from 11.3 to 0 per 1,000 catheter days. And in this study that was published in 2004, they saved almost $2 million per year on the cost of bloodstream infections. Well, as a result of that, you may remember that the Michigan Hospital Association adopted this and took on the checklist idea in something called the Keystone Project that involved 127 intensive care units in Michigan and 5 other states. 68 of those ICUs totally eliminated BSIs, and for 6 months they also eliminated ventilator-associated pneumonia. They estimated that there was a saving of about $165 million. And then hospitals in other states, Rhode Island, New Jersey, Maryland, replicated this, and that was published in the New England Journal in 2006. Well, then what happened on the next slide is that after the results were published in 2006, in 2007, somebody contacted the Office of Human Research Protection, which is the federal agency that oversees research that receives funding from the federal budget, and said that they were concerned because the patients in the project did not give informed consent. And so in August of 2007, the project was suspended by this federal agency. The next question was, Was this quality improvement project also human subjects research? Well, yes, it was, but actually they weren't doing anything experimental, were they? They were just implementing things that had already been shown to work. It was research, so but the question is, if it was research, could the IRB approval have been expedited? And again, the answer there is yes. An expedited protocol is one which is minimal risk. It doesn't impact on patients, any of the patient's legal rights. And so absolutely, it could have been expedited. And so the next question is, was informed consent really required? Well, the question is, if you are doing a checklist with the things that you're supposed to do for inserting a catheter, and all you're doing is evaluating the results, do you really need to get written consent or informed consent from every patient? And there, I think the answer is absolutely no. So even though the Office of Human Research Protection shut them down, the answer was no. And there was a big public outcry. On the next page, the final outcome was that 2 months afterwards, the Office of Human Research Protection changed their mind, and they said that a waiver of consent was perfectly appropriate. And that was all written up in the New England Journal. My point of this, and I'm going to go on with this for a little while, this case study, is that just putting more rules in place does not necessarily protect people more. So the next page, this is Peter Pronovost's testimony before the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, when he says in 2008, the OHRP charged that the Michigan project violated regulations to protect patients who participated in research. Though ultimately the office indicated that the work could continue, there is great concern across the country regarding whether doing the same project in California or Ohio or implementing other new quality improvement programs would violate federal regulations. The healthcare community wants clarity regarding the ethical oversight of quality improvement efforts. So on the next slide, it just talks a little bit about differentiating quality improvement with research. And with research, you are testing beyond current knowledge. Sometimes you randomly allocate things to participants. The researcher sometimes delays feedback to avoid biasing the interpretation of data. And the interest of research is really to contribute to general knowledge, not just to solve a local problem, but also to have it have an impact more generally. So sometimes those two overlap considerably. And the concern is that many of the things we do in infection prevention must and should be evaluated, and we need to do ongoing kinds of quality improvement. So we don't want the federal government regs to interfere with actually doing what we think is part of our job. The next in the next slide, the final outcome is that OHRP rescinded its decision and now agrees that this was not research, although actually it was initially, because it had then been shown to work. And now the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality is funding the study to expand to other sites. The next slide, if I plan to carry out a quality improvement project and publish, does the intent to publish make my project fit the regulatory definition of research? And the Office of Human Research says no, the intent to publish is not a sufficient criterion for determining whether a quality improvement activity involves research. The next slide just is a reference to another study that used the checklist idea, this time applied to surgical safety checklists to reduce morbidity and mortality. And on the next slide, it just was a study of the WHO Safe Surgery Program that involved hospitals in Toronto, New Delhi, Amman, Auckland, Manila, Ifakara, London, Seattle. And they reported a declining in the death rate from 1.5 to 0.8% and a significant decline in inpatient complications using the checklist. Next slide. They did say, however, that the human subject committees of Harvard, WHO, and each hospital approved the study and waived the requirement for written informed consent. So the next slide is striking the balance. What is the evidence that increasing regulation for research actually yields better protections and improved understanding among research participants? And there actually is not much evidence to show that all these regulations are really helping patients. They're more protecting the institution. Next slide. This is a quote that I really like. The degree of scrutiny and oversight for a research study, I'm just paraphrasing now, should match the risk of the study. So minimal risk studies should be handled diligently, but in a fast way, and should not be held up by, you know, a lot of rules and regulations. Next slide. There is some proposed changes in the U.S. in what's called the Common Rule, which is to simplify the process of human subjects research and to put the emphasis on the right syllable. So we'll see how that goes, but it will have some significant impact on how we get our research approved. Next slide. This is just another reference for you addressing low-risk comparative effectiveness research in proposed changes to U.S. federal regulations. So, next slide, what do we do? I want to change now, on the next slide, to again quote one of my friends, Carla Alvarado, who said, whatever we do, we need simple rules, and then we all need to agree on these rules. We need no patient being harmed by a healthcare-associated infection. Targeting zero infections is a laudable goal. We may never get there, but it's a laudable and appropriate goal. Infection prevention must be an organizational goal, not just a goal of the infection prevention team. Chief executives must deliver clear expectations and set goals and provide resources, and we must create a culture in which everyone feels responsible for infection prevention, not just the infection control staff. On the next slide, I want to talk for a minute about what it means to be a successful leader in terms of having an impact on infections. And this is a nice study by Sanjay Saint and his colleagues. Basically, it was a qualitative study to look at what characteristics of a leader were associated with better infection prevention practices. And here's what he found, that the leader had to be someone characterized as cultivating a culture of excellence, communicating this expectation to the staff, focusing on overcoming barriers, dealing directly with resistant staff, not just being passive and actually head-on talking to people about what their problem was, being inspirational, thinking strategically, leveraging their personal prestige, and forming interdisciplinary partnerships. So these are the characteristics that have been found in leaders who are able to have a positive impact on infection prevention programs. Next slide, a study that showed that healthcare workers in a room with higher-ranking medical staff person or a peer who did not wash their hands were significantly less likely to wash their hands. So again, this idea of leadership and a role model. The other thing in the next slide is that it's very hopeful to know that one's local culture is probably more important than discipline, than whether you're a physician or a nurse in making a difference. For example, in this study, physician hand hygiene varied hugely from 4% on a gynecology unit to 96% on a neonatal IC unit within one hospital. And they also found that variations in hand hygiene rates were as much as 33% and 77% between hospitals. So what they concluded was that the local environment, not whether you're a physician or a nurse or whatever, but where you work and the culture that's created in the hospital and the unit where you work, is the most consistent, important role in affecting people's interest in performing appropriately. So on the next slide, targeting the leaders. Now, this was a study during a multifaceted hand hygiene promotional program on 35 wards. What they found was that it didn't really matter how busy the staff was, surprisingly. That did not affect adherence to hand hygiene. But what did affect adherence was job seniority, so that those who had worked longer were more likely to have improved adherence and to have an impact on the unit. And then the next slide, targeting the message. This is a study of focus groups, four focus groups of physicians that who were asked to talk a little bit about why they what they thought about hand hygiene and why they chose to do it. Three of the focus groups were physicians in training in anesthesiology surgery emergency, and one of the focus groups was internal medicine residents. Next slide. The themes that they found in these interviews was that, in general, the physicians overestimated what they knew. They thought they knew more than they actually did, but they didn't necessarily believe anybody else either. They were also, however, very concerned about what the patient thought and what patients perceived. They emphasized that there needed to be more funding to improve hand hygiene, which I absolutely do not agree with at all, and I can't imagine where that came from. Because, I mean, it's not going to cost us a lot to improve hand hygiene. And then the other theme was that the medical hierarchy, that is, who's in power and who's perceived as being more senior, was very critical to their behavior, so that if someone more senior to them did hand hygiene, they were more likely to do it. So these are kinds of the things that give us some idea of how we can actually have an impact on behavior. So moving beyond the simplistic, even though hands are substantially cleaner, the benefit is uncertain. Our focus, and I'm quoting these things from Kent Supkowitz, our focus on building better hand hygiene programs may have misled us into believing that we're doing something about a problem that remains intractable. And I'm quite concerned and saddened when I hear so many of my colleagues who are very, very discouraged and sometimes even get angry at staff because they don't do hand hygiene or they won't listen to them or the education doesn't work or whatever. But I think we can't keep thinking like that. We have got to work as leaders and realize that our clients are not individual nurses and doctors so much as it is actually trying to change the organizational climate on in an entire hospital or on an entire unit or in some kind of a facility. And that goes back to what we heard in the qualitative studies in California, that is that the organizational culture is essential before one can actually have success in one's work. So as leaders in infection prevention, we need to really assume, take that leadership, and then present to the administrators in wherever we work the kinds of plans that we think are needed and the kinds of support, not just asking for more money. Sometimes it can even be cheaper, but getting their cultural support for changes. The next slide, and I think this is my last slide. No, there's a couple more. Is a quote from Kent Supkowitz from Lancet ID, where he says, "The time has come for the infection control community to move on. We must reacquaint ourselves with that lonely feeling familiar to clinicians when they realize a case is much more difficult than it appears. We should embrace the intellectual audacity of our beloved Semmelweis, but let go of his how-to manual and stop thinking that we're going to change behavior with in-service education." These changes, social changes that are occurring, more pressure for transparency in the public, mandatory reporting, changes in the reimbursement structure, and changes in the way we do research can help move us forward. And we need to learn how to work in new and more efficient ways. So here's just another quote that I think really is a reflection of these phases that the infection control community has gone through since it really first started in the 1970s. It says, seen in geological perspective, we are fossils in the making, to be buried and eventually exposed again for the puzzlement of creatures of later eras. One of us doesn't differ that much from another. Each generation repeats its parents. The works we build to outlast us are not much more enduring than anthills and much less so than coral reefs. Here everything returns upon itself, repeats, and renews itself. And I'm not citing that to be depressing or to be discouraging, but to say that in some, often we need to go back to sort of our basic mission and our basic thoughts about how to prevent infections with hygiene, etc., and learn new ways and new media, but don't forget what our basic mission is. So lastly, folks, I'm telling you, birthing is hard and dying is mean, so let yourself get yourself a little loving in between.
Dr. Larson, thank you very much for that. I think a lecture that ends with a Langston Hughes quote is always a good thing.
Yeah, well, Langston Hughes, actually, you know, I live in Harlem, and he his house was a block from where I live. So I love his poetry, yeah.
I would direct people's attention to the second-to-last slide. That is number 68. That just lists a few of the topics that are coming up in the next few weeks, and you'll see that the next one is with Dr. Benedetta Allegranzi from the World Health Organization, Improving Patient Safety Culture as a Successful Component of Infection Control Strategies, which links very neatly in with this lecture today in terms of changing the culture, not just trying to re-educate.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because I think that there's a book called The Tipping Point, which some of you may have read. But
oh, of course.
It seems to me that we're at a tipping point where we have come to realize in a lot of different venues, and then it sort of all folds in together, that infection prevention cannot work in isolation or in a silo. And now that some of these federal mandates are coming through, it actually is the perfect opportunity to take it and run with it and own it, because there's the regulatory clout behind what we're trying to accomplish. So rather than feeling bad about it, I think this is a terrific opportunity.
Very good. And I very much like your comment that improving hand hygiene compliance does not need an input of money. It needs an input of willingness.
And I actually have to say that I couldn't, at first I didn't even understand what that theme was that the physicians talked about, and I still am not sure I understand why they think that money is going to make a difference. But anyway.
Money always makes a difference.
If there's
something wrong, throw money at it.
Yeah.
The teleclass has now come to a close, so I will thank you all for joining us. And Dr. Larson, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
So until we talk again,
okay.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.